Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Some medical workers ignore a strike call in Liberia. South African runner Oscar Pistorius is back in court. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. Most health workers in Liberia are reporting to work today, ignoring calls for a strike that could have weakened efforts to fight the Ebola epidemic. The country's Health Workers Association had told members to stay home unless they received higher hazard pay promised by the Liberian government. But hospitals and health officials say the majority of nurses and physicians' assistants came to work and medical facilities were operating. South African runner Oscar Pistorius is back in a Pretoria court for a hearing to determine his sentence for killing his girlfriend, Reeva Steenkamp, last year. He faces up to 15 years in prison after being convicted in September of culpable homicide. His lawyers will argue for leniency. Today, Joel Moringa, a social worker for South Africa's Department of Correction Services, suggested home detention for Pistorius.
That the accused be placed under house arrest for the duration of his sentence with due consideration of his work, cooperation in general, and other relevant circumstances in order to bring home the element of punishment to the accused and to attempt to prevent further crime perpetration by means of strict control and management.
Pistorius admitted to shooting Steenkamp but said he thought he was firing at an intruder. The AFP News Service reports that the former wife of South African President Nelson Mandela has been admitted to a hospital. Her daughter says Winnie Madikizela-Mandela will undergo surgery. The surgery is intended to improve her blood circulation. This is VOA News. The AFP reports that a new United Nations report released today says Somalia's government is corrupt and that Al-Shabaab Islamist rebels are as dangerous there as ever. The report says weapons sent to the army were put on sale and ended up in the hands of the militants. The report also said a third of the revenue from the port of Mogadishu cannot be accounted for. There was fighting in Mozambique between members of the ruling Frelimo Party and members of the opposition Renamo Party. The violence came as voters prepared to go to the polls this week. In a brawl that broke out Sunday in Nampula, the AFP News Service reports 23 people injured and 13 arrested. Former Madagascar President Marc Ravalomanana was taken into custody by special forces today, shortly after he returned from exile in South Africa. President Harry Rajo Narimampianina told reporters that the former president is being held for his protection and that he has not been arrested or jailed. Mr. Ravalomanana fled the country after he was ousted from office in 2009. The International Energy Agency says the energy sector in sub-Saharan Africa needs to be overhauled. The IEA said at a London press conference today that more modern access to energy is necessary for Africa's economic and social development. The organization says two-thirds of the population of sub-Saharan Africa lives without electricity. Reuters reports that 10 Chinese hostages, among 27 held by Boko Haram in Cameroon, were greeted today by President Paul Biya at a reception. The government was said to be instrumental in gaining the release of the workers who were flown to Yaoundé on Sunday from the far north of the country. President Biya said his government would go after Boko Haram, quoting now, until it's totally wiped out. Hundreds of people fought today with pro-democracy protesters in central Hong Kong. Some in the group confronting the protesters tried to break down barriers that had been erected at the site. Turkey says it has not agreed with the U.S. to let American forces use a base in the country to launch operations against Islamic State militants in Syria and Iraq. U.S. officials said today that an agreement had been reached to use the base in Incirlik as a staging ground for airstrikes, but Turkey says no agreement has been reached and that negotiations are continuing. Francis Jean Tirole has been awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics for research on market power and regulation. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences announced the $1.1 million prize today in Stockholm. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhiv in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Before this outbreak occurred, we didn't have enough healthcare workers. Now with these vast numbers of cases, the gap is widening as we speak. So we are trying to catch up by training as many people as possible and also by receiving, gratefully receiving, offers of help from overseas.
That's Dr. Margaret Harris of the World Health Organization talking about the lack of healthcare workers during the Ebola outbreak. Details coming up. Also in the news, the renowned African academic Ali Mazrui has died today at age 81. We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny. Music from Niger and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, South African track star Oscar Pistorius is back in Pretoria's High Court for sentencing after being found guilty of culpable homicide for killing his model girlfriend, Riva Steenkamp. Pistorius could face up to 15 years in prison, although there is a chance he may walk free. Gillian Parker reports from Pretoria. The sentencing hearing is expected to last several days.
27-year-old Olympic and Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius was found guilty last month of negligently killing Riva Steenkamp on Valentine's Day last year when he shot four 9mm rounds through a bathroom door in what he said was a mistaken belief a burglar was lurking behind it. Culpable homicide, South Africa's equivalent of manslaughter, is punishable by up to 15 years in prison, community service or a fine. Judge Thokozile Masipa will sentence Pistorius this week, capping a six-month on-off trial that has chronicled the fall from grace of the double amputee athlete, who was once revered in South Africa as the ultimate example of triumph over adversity. The sprinter, dubbed the Blade Runner because of the carbon fibre prosthetics he uses to run, sat solemnly in the dock Monday as witnesses gave their testimony. Pistorius' psychologist was the first defence witness to speak at the hearing. She described Pistorius as a man in deep remorse, describing him as very emotional during therapy sessions, which were often disrupted by the athlete weeping and retching.
It is foreseen that Mr. Pistorius will require intensive and ongoing psychotherapy. What we are left with, my lady, we are left with a broken man who has lost everything.
The second defence witness was Department of Correctional Services social worker Joel Moringa, who argued that Pistorius would be a good candidate for house arrest, subject to strict guidelines, and should be forbidden from owning a firearm.
He is going to be put within his own environment. He will not do as he wishes. He always have to ask for permission. And also, he has got to attend the programs, which are aimed basically at reforming him.
He told the court that community service would entail 16 hours a month, when Pistorius would be required to do domestic work. When prosecutor Jerry Nell asked Moringa how long he would recommend that Pistorius undergo house arrest, he replied that 3 years would be suitable. Nell disagreed.
You think that is in the interest of society, that reflects the seriousness of the crime, that somebody should be sent to 3 years correctional supervision for having killed an innocent woman in a house. To even suggest 3 years is shockingly inappropriate for what happened in this matter.
Amid growing discontent in South Africa at the verdict, Judge Masipa has been criticised for being too lenient on the athlete, bolstering a belief that the country's justice favours rich, white suspects. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Pretoria.
The renowned African academic Ali Mazrui died today at the age of 81. At his death, Professor Mazrui was the Albert Schweitzer Professor in the Humanities and the director of the Institute of Global Cultural Studies at the State University of New York at Binghamton. He had been suffering a lingering illness for several months. His body will be flown to Kenya for burial. Mr. Mazrui was born in Mombasa, Kenya in 1933. He attended Oxford University and later studied at Makerere University, where he became head of the political science department and dean of the social science faculty. The African scholar was forced into exile from Uganda during the rule of Idi Amin. He joined the faculty at the University of Michigan in 1974. We are joined in the studio by Straight Talk Africa host Shaka Sali to discuss the impact of Professor Mazrui's scholarship on popular understanding of modern Africa. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta today said that Africa has been robbed of one of its great scholars. As you well know, Shaka, this towering academic played a major role in the shaping the intellect of Africa. Talk to me, if you will, Shaka, a little more about the life, contributions, and legacy of this great Pan-Africanist.
First of all, having had the privilege and the honor of knowing Professor Ali Mazrui in so many different ways, including having hosted him on Straight Talk Africa several times, having traveled with him on Ethiopian Airlines in 1970 from Dares to Addis Ababa, and spent a night with him at the Addis Sheraton, spent a week with him attending a UNESCO conference in Djibouti, and so many other times, I have to frankly say that I would like to take this opportunity first and foremost to extend my heartfelt condolences to his wife Pauline Uti from Nigeria, his children, and the rest of his family. Having said that, he was a remarkably gifted individual. He was the sort of person that had the command of the English language and spoke it in a manner that probably even superseded people who call the English language their first and only language. He was very poetic. He had incredible humility, very knowledgeable. He was, according to many scholars, of course, perhaps the heavyweight boxing intellectual champion of Africa. Indeed, he was an intellectual peer, a treasure, an intellectual, in fact, some might add, for the ages.
You just mentioned it a little earlier, and we all have interacted over time or one time or another with the renowned Kenyan academic Ali Mazrui in the form of interviews, attending his lectures, meeting him personally. Tell me more about, Shaka, about your own personal interaction with this great African.
You know, growing up in Uganda, where, of course, he made his name as a professor at Makerere University, debating then Ugandan Prime Minister Dr. Apollo Milton Obote. I remember one time when he debated Kenyan founding Vice President Jaramogi Oginga Odinga, who happens, by the way, to be the father of Raila Odinga. And I remember calling him at one time, in fact, in my interview, as the president. Perhaps the president that Kenya never had. He had a way of playing with words. He was enormously gifted. He was a poet. You know, Mazrui had, by the way, even worked as a journalist. As a graduate student at Oxford, where he did a doctorate of philosophy in political science in the early 60s, he worked for the BBC, Kiswahili Service. That was Mazrui. You know, it's not an accident, frankly, that he became that kind of person, because, after all, he came from incredible pedigree. His father was the chief Qadi of Muslims in East Africa.
Yes.
In East Africa. But ironically, this is a man, after his ordinary levels, high school, he failed to make it to Makerere. He couldn't be accepted to Makerere until 3 years later he gets a scholarship and goes to the United Kingdom. And a university like Makerere, which could not admit him as a student, guess what? He ended up being the towering professor of the great university of East Africa, Makerere University College.
Tell me, we were talking about this privately, about when you physically saw him, this,
you know,
great giant,
I had,
intellectual giant.
I had, obviously, as I said, had a lot of things about him, read about him, admired him, and so much. But it wasn't until, you can't believe this, until 1990 that I first met him physically in Albany, upstate New York. I looked at him, and he looked like a guy I had seen hosting The Africans, a controversial documentary on Africa and Islam, which aired back in 1986. And so I said, "You must be Ali Mazrui." He said, "Of course I am Ali Mazrui. You just met Ali Mazrui." I just told him at the time I had my slave name called Mike Sully before I became Shaka. And he invited me to his place in Binghamton, where we spent 3 days having some red wine and getting some words of wisdom from the great intellectual professor.
Thank you, Shaka. And in 2005, the U.S. Journal of Foreign Policy and British Journal Prospect listed Ali Mazrui as among the world's top 100 public intellectuals. You were listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Sixteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Renowned Kenyan academic Ali Mazrui has died at age 81, and the World Health Organization reports the death toll from the Ebola in three West African countries has passed the 4,000 mark. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. The World Health Organization has released an update on the Ebola situation in Sierra Leone. It says the outbreak continues to accelerate with nearly 3,000 cases reported as of October 8th. More than 930 people have died. Dr. Margaret Harris is the spokesperson for the WHO country office in Sierra Leone. She says there has been an exponential rise in Ebola cases. From the capital, Freetown, she spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa about what's needed to level out the number of new cases.
It's going to take a lot more capacity on the ground. Well, what does that mean? That means lots of people out there in the community finding all the cases, making sure all the people who are ill are managed and are also isolated from other people so that they're not infecting other people. That means we have to have many, many, many more treatment beds than we've got at the moment, because we need to be able to get those people to treatment where they can be isolated and safely nursed and ideally recover from their illness.
And what is the status of that effort to get more beds?
There is a big gap. So we're getting a lot of help now. We've had the British military arrive, and they're working incredibly hard to construct a huge treatment centre. We're refitting a number of hospitals that were general hospitals, and we've changed them and turned them into Ebola treatment hospitals. But to do that, you have to make pretty major changes to make sure that the very ill people who come in not just ill, but with an infection that is highly lethal and highly lethal for the people looking after them and for anybody in contact with them, in physical contact with them. So you have to make all sorts of changes within the hospital to ensure that when you bring them in and when you look after them, you minimize the risk, and not just to themselves, but also to all the people looking after them. In another sort of outbreak, you could open a lot of beds really much, much more quickly, but in these circumstances, it takes far more time than we really have often to get the beds we really need to make sure everybody can get cared for.
Is there an adequate number of healthcare workers in Sierra Leone at this time to handle the crisis?
No. And that's the other thing we're racing to build up. So we've got a huge amount of training going on. Before this outbreak occurred, we didn't have enough healthcare workers. Now, with these vast numbers of cases, the gap is widening as we speak. So we are trying to catch up by training as many people as possible, and also by gratefully receiving, offers of help from overseas. So, for instance, we had 165 doctors and nurses arrive from Cuba. We've got British arriving. We've got people from other countries arriving. And, of course, in Liberia, I can't speak for Liberia, but there's been a massive American effort as well. And these are going to make a difference. But as I said, there is a gap between arriving and actually being able to get in there and help, because everybody has to have a place in which they can help, and they have to have the proper equipment, and they have to have really specialized training. No matter how good a doctor you are, you don't know how to treat Ebola, because until now, Ebola only happened in a few very isolated places. There were very few people who actually understood how to look after someone with Ebola and also how to stay safe.
Do you believe the general population in Sierra Leone now understands the risks and understands how they might catch Ebola?
Where people have been infected, where we've got a lot of cases, people understand very, very well. What we do see is when it arrives in a new district, it's so shocking for people to suddenly see people fall ill and die in a relatively short period of a disease they've never seen anything like. So when that first happens, quite often a lot of rumours go around that it was some kind of supernatural event or something like that. But as people in the same family fall ill and die, they begin to understand that this is not something that somebody brought upon themselves because of behaviour or whatever. This is an infection and an illness that they need help for, and they need to know how to deal with.
Are people still going about their daily lives, or has movement been greatly restricted?
Movement has been greatly restricted. If you came to Freetown, you would say, well, no, I can see people on the streets, I can see cars, I can see the things that look normal in a city. But people who live here say many of the shops are closed, many of the businesses are closed, people have lost their jobs, the schools are closed. UNICEF's begun organising a school of the air lessons on the radio, but many of the normal activities simply are not going on. And in some of the agricultural communities, so many people have died. You don't have farmers who can go out in the fields anymore. You've got empty villages.
What lessons are being learned from this?
One of the biggest lessons, and it was something we have been talking about for a good 10, 20 years, is the importance of a really strong health system. What happened here was an infection that nobody understood arrived in a health system that was not able to meet the normal needs of its population. So that combination meant, as somebody has described, was like a perfect storm. I'd just like to say it's heartening to see the international response and the response from your country and other countries that are now bringing in as much as possible. And if that continues and we get more people, more expertise, we will overcome this.
Dr. Margaret Harris is the spokesperson for the World Health Organization country office in Sierra Leone. From the capital, Freetown, she spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua. The World Health Organization reports the death toll from Ebola in three West African countries has passed the 4,000 mark. The widespread and intense transmission of the Ebola virus disease in Liberia, Sierra Leone and Guinea has infected more than 8,400 people. Four other countries with initial or localized transmissions have identified a total of 23 infections and 9 deaths. 8 of the deaths occurred in Nigeria and 1 in Dallas, Texas. Intensified Ebola virus screening of air passengers from West African countries to the United States began yesterday at John F. Kennedy International Airport in New York. Temperatures are taken with a no-touch thermometer. As Liberia tries to end a months-long Ebola crisis, local and international media rights groups report an intensifying crackdown on journalists in the country. But journalists say this is only a continuation of Liberia's bad record on press freedom. Mrs. Sirleaf's treatment of the press taints the West's positive image of President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf as Africa's first elected female head of state and the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011. Benno Muchler reports.
7 months into the worst Ebola outbreak ever, several media rights groups accused the Liberian government of preventing journalists from reporting the magnitude of the crisis. Last week, Liberia's Deputy Minister of Information said on the radio that his government will prevent journalists from entering Ebola treatment units in order to protect the privacy of the patients. Critics see this as an attempt to hide facts about the ongoing outbreak that has killed more than 2,300 Liberians and damaged the national economy. On October 8th, the World Health Organization said the reported fall in the number of new cases in Liberia over the past 3 weeks is unlikely to be genuine and rather reflects a lack of capacity in data gathering. Liberia's Minister of Information, Louis Brown, says the allegations of government interference in Ebola news coverage are not true and adds that the government has always put an emphasis on strengthening press freedom.
Even though we are in a state of emergency, we have not permitted ourselves to slip into a situation where we were denied free speech and freedom of information. We have not and will not. We fought too hard, including the president. The president is a champion for rights and freedom. All her life, she's fought for it.
Media rights groups have a different view. Abdoulaye Camara, who is the president of the Press Union of Liberia, says the government has tried to restrict the media on several occasions during the Ebola crisis.
There's a case involving the Women Voices newspaper, and the paper actually wrote about corruption within the police in respect to Ebola-related activities. And the publisher was invited to the police station and virtually harassed.
The Committee to Protect Journalists, an international media watchdog, says another newspaper, the National Chronicle, was raided by police, citing urgent national security concerns as justification for their actions. National Chronicle publisher Philibert Brown was present during the raid.
During the interim, the police had thrown tear gas into our office, so we fled from the front of the office to the back where we had the ventilation to breathe. In about 5 minutes after they threw the tear gas, we started hearing the bang, bang, the heavy sound of them breaking down the office door.
The incident took place after the National Chronicle had run a story about the plans of a group of Liberians to form a new government. But publisher Brown believes the closure of his newspaper came after the coverage of massive corruption cases, including the son of President Johnson Sirleaf.
It's so disappointing that a woman of that stature, you know, just you wouldn't even believe it. Every day you read the newspaper, from beginning to end, it's about corruption. She does nothing about it. All right? She does nothing to reprimand. Every time she comes out and she appoints a panel to investigate corruption, it ends with the panel.
The National Chronicle remains shut down while the case is being tried at Liberia's Supreme Court. Liberia is ranked 89th out of 180 countries in the Reporters Without Borders 2014 Press Freedom Index. Benno Müchler for VOA News, Monrovia.
And in more news from the continent, in Egypt, 30 passengers were killed when two minibuses collided early this morning. The accident occurred on a highway on the west bank of the Nile River. A third bus also struck the wreckage. Security officials in Aswan province say the dead were residents of Fayoum, an oasis south of Cairo. And a rebel militia from Libya's western city of Zintan claims to have retaken an Islamist stronghold near the capital Tripoli. More than 23 died in the clash yesterday between the fighters from Zintan and forces of the Libya Dawn. A coalition of Islamists and fighters from the coastal city of Misrata, Libya Dawn retains control of most of the capital.
I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Renowned Kenyan academic Ali Mazrui has died at age 81. And the World Health Organization reports the death toll from Ebola in three West African countries has passed the 4,000 mark. Coming up, music from Niger. And in our feature segment, artists across the Middle East attacking Islamic State fighters with jokes, mockery, music, cartoons, and videos. I'm Yehiz Huhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Yehiz.
I understand. What is your sports menu tonight?
Well, yes, I begin in South Africa. Thank you. In South Africa, a sentencing hearing has begun for South African athlete Oscar Pistorius. Pistorius was found guilty of the culpable homicide of his girlfriend, River Steenkamp, last month, but was cleared of murder. On the first day of his sentencing hearing on Monday, a probation officer appearing for the defense has said Pistorius should serve house arrest and community service. He faces up to 15 years in jail, although Judge Thokozile Masipa may suspend the sentence or impose a fine. At the sentencing hearing, Joel Maringa, a prison service officer summoned by the defense, said Pistorius should perform community service and receive 3 years of house arrest rather than imprisonment. But prosecutor Gary Nail described Mr. Maringa's suggestions as, in his words, shockingly inappropriate, adding that they would amount to no sentence. The sentencing hearing, which has now been adjourned, is expected to last several days. It was a weekend of surprises and in some cases upsets at the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers. Defending African champions Nigeria fell to a shock 1-0 defeat away to Sudan to slump to the bottom of Group A. From Lagos, Nigeria, Nightline Africa's Segun Ondedo Tadiyeme has a roundup of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers. Hello, Segun.
Good evening, Douglas, and good evening, Africa. They are the defending champions, but they may not even get a chance to defend their title. They are the Super Eagles of Nigeria, and they risk missing out of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations in Morocco. In the resumed group stage qualifying for the tournament this weekend, the Nigerian senior football side lost by a lone goal to its Sudanese counterpart and host. It was another shock defeat for Nigeria in the qualifiers, after the Super Eagles lost 3-2 at home to Congo on September 6th. Babika Bakri headed home in the 42nd minute to give Sudan his first points in the group. The latest loss means Nigeria faces the possibility of missing out on the chance to defend his title next year. Nigeria, which won the tournament in 2013, has only a single point midway into the group stage of the tournament. The defending champions still have a mathematical chance of qualifying. They will have to win all their three remaining matches in Group A to make that happen. That is not impossible, but the performance of the Nigerian team in recent times gives little hope that such a feat could be achieved. Also in danger of not qualifying for next year's tournament is Zambia, the 2012 champion. The Chipolopolo of Zambia were held to a draw away in Niger, leaving them with just 2 points from three games in Group F. Algeria continued to live up to its billing as Africa's top-ranked team. It emerged from this weekend's qualifiers as the only remaining side with a 100% record from three games in Group B. Central defender Rafik Kalichi headed home from a corner after 10 minutes, and Jamil Mesbah added another in a 2-0 away win over Malawi in Blantyre. The victory moved the Algerians closer to becoming the first team to secure a place at the finals. Burkina Faso, Cameroon, the Cape Verde Islands, and Congo all dropped points for the first time in their respective encounters. Gabon overcame Burkina Faso 2-0 at home in Libreville while Cameroon, after beating the powerful Ivory Coast in their last game, was held to an unexpected goalless draw by Sierra Leone. The match was moved to Yaoundé because of a ban on playing at home following the Ebola virus outbreak. Cape Verde, surprise quarter-finalists at the last finals, had its winning run ended in a 2-0 defeat in Mozambique, while Congo was beaten 2-0 at home by a resurgent South Africa. The Ivory Coast and Mali bounced back from defeat in their last qualifiers with wins on Saturday, while Togo, led by Emmanuel Adebayo, won his first points with a 1-0 away victory in Uganda. The Ivorians triumphed 2-1 away at the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DR Congo, while Mali won 2-0 in Ethiopia. Ghana, playing under caretaker management after firing coach Kwesi Appiah last month, considered a late goal to Guinea in a 1-1 draw in Casablanca. Let's now give a quick rundown of all the results. The first named teams are hosts. Group A, Congo 0, South Africa 2. Sudan 1, Nigeria 0. South Africa is the new group leader on 7 points, followed by former group leader Congo on 6, Sudan on 3, and Nigeria on 1. Group B, Malawi 0, Algeria 2. Ethiopia 0, Mali 2. Algeria is the runaway leader on 9 points, followed by Mali on 6, Malawi on 3, and Ethiopia 0. Group C, Lesotho 0, Angola 0. Gabon 2, Burkina Faso 0. Gabon leads on 7 points, one more than second place Burkina Faso. Lesotho is third on 2 points, while Angola takes Urea on 1. Group D, Sierra Leone 0, Cameroon 0. Democratic Republic of Congo 1, Ivory Coast 2. Cameroon leads on 7 points, Ivory Coast follows on 6, DR Congo on 3, and Sierra Leone on 1. Group E, Uganda 0, Togo 1. Guinea 1, Ghana 1. Ghana leads on 5 points, followed by Uganda on 4. Same as Guinea, which however has inferior goal difference. Togo has 3 points. Group F, Mozambique 2, Cape Verde 0. Nigeria 0, Zambia 0. Cape Verde is the group leader on 6 points. Next is Mozambique on 5, Zambia on 2, and Niger on 2. And Group G, Botswana 0, Egypt 2, Senegal 0, Tunisia 0. Senegal and Tunisia are tied on 7 points atop the group, but Senegal has a slight edge on goal differential. Egypt has 3 points, while Botswana has none. Back here in Nigeria, local newspapers on Sunday reflected the disappointment among Nigerian fans. Their headlines left no one in doubt about the disaster that the Super Eagles lost to Sudan represents. Sudan sinks Eagles in Khartoum was the headline in the Sunday Sun. Eagles crash in Sudan was how Sunday Vanguard reported the outcome. Sudan outruns sorry Super Eagles in Khartoum, the nation. AFCON qualifier, lackluster Eagles lose 1-0 to Sudan, Sunday Punch. And Sudan kicks Eagles out of 2015 AFCON race leadership were some of the other headlines. Meanwhile, this weekend's qualifiers were overshadowed by a surprise announcement on Friday that Morocco wants to postpone January's tournament because of fears over the spread of the Ebola pandemic. But African soccer's governing body, CAF, on Saturday rejected the idea but said it will meet the Moroccan government next month for talks on the issue. Moroccan health officials fear that the biennial 16-nation 3-week African football showpiece could trigger a spread of the deadly virus. Calling Ebola a major health problem, an advisor to Moroccan sports minister Mohamed Ouzine reiterated the country's reluctance to host the tournament. Should the tournament be shifted from Morocco, South Africa could potentially step in to stage it, having twice before come to the rescue of the tournament organizers. The Guineans play home matches in the Moroccan city of Casablanca. Finally, the draw for the 2014 FIFA Club World Cup, to be hosted by Morocco for the second year in a row, was made by tournament organizer FIFA on Saturday. According to the draw, host Morocco, represented by Club Maghreb Tetouan, will enter the tournament in the playoff round, where it will take on Oceania champion Auckland City on December 10th. Africa's representative at the tournament, which will be the winner of the 2014 African Champions League, will enter in the quarterfinal stage against the winner of the playoff game on December 13th. The African Champions League final will be played by AS Setif of Algeria and AS Vita of DR Congo. The FIFA Club World Cup features the champion clubs from each of the six continental confederations, as well as the National League champion from the host country. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas the Mighty Mpuga in Washington.
Thanks, Segun. That was Segun, Nightline Africa's Segun on the dot ADMA reporting from Lagos. Now let's join Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, for more sports news.
We begin with athletics. Kenyan defending champion Rita Jeptoe clocked 2 hours 24 minutes and 35 seconds to retain her Bank of America Chicago Marathon crown in the United States of America on Sunday. Ethiopian Mary Dibaba was second ahead of Kenyan Florence Kiplagat. In the men's race, Eliud Kipchoge clocked 2 hours 4 minutes and 11 seconds to lead Sammy Kitwara and Dickson Chumba in a 1-2-3 Kenyan medal podium sweep. Ethiopian Kenenisa Bekele was fourth. Turning to football, Algeria pipped Ghana 1-0 as Cameroon edged South Africa 1-0 in Group B action at the Telecom and Namibia Mobile Africa Women's Championship in Windhoek, Namibia on Sunday. Early on Saturday, Namibia beat Zambia 2-0 and Nigeria dismissed Ivory Coast 4-2. Today, Monday, action resumes in Group A when Zambia challenge Nigeria and Namibia encounter Ivory Coast. Finally, hosts Tanzania thrashed Benin 4-1 in a friendly played in Dar es Salaam. Today, Monday, Morocco host Kenya in Marrakesh.
That was Mark Ouma reporting in Johannesburg, South Africa. Before we go in tennis, Roger Federer won his first Shanghai Masters title with a straight sets victory over Gael Simon. The Swiss world number three let out a huge roar after unseeded Frenchman Simon hit a forehand into the net to give him a 7-6, 8-6, 7-6, 7-2 victory.
I feel it's unbelievable prestige to win this event, especially put my hands on the trophy for the first time is a good feeling, I must say, and I'm very happy with the way I'm playing. So overall, I'm just extremely happy right now. So this year, I think everything's going really well, and I have still so many highlights to look forward to for the end of the season, which is very nice, because usually everything slows down at the end of the season. But not for me this time.
The 33-year-old Federer won the opening set with his only backhand winner down the line. Simon led 6-5 in the second set and had two set points, but two unforced errors allowed Federer a way back, and the 17-time Grand Slam winner took advantage. For 29-year-old Simon, who went off court for a medical timeout after the first set, it was a second defeat in the Masters final, having lost in Madrid to Murray in 2008. And that's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Mpuga. Now back to your house.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, artists across the Middle East attacking Islamic State fighters with jokes, mockery, music, cartoons, and videos. And next, we focus on the debilitating disease called nodding syndrome. But first, some music. Here is Iskaidan Gaskia of Niger with Africa.
Oh Lord, Africa, hey. Yes, man, for a peace and love night in Africa. For rights, God bless Africa. Africa, Africa. What's up now?
Africa dying, my people crying. Slay. Every day, boy, yo, yo, yo. Man, I'll peace and love night in Africa. Hey, hey, hey. Les bombes bagasses nationales, les bombes chimiques nationales, les bombes atomiques nationales, les bombes nucléaires nationales, les chars de guerre nationales, les armes de guerre nationales, l'avion de guerre nationale, l'avion de guerre nationale.
De voir l'Afrique s'unir, plus de guerre, plus de mort, plus de gênant, plus de mon rêve. C'est de voir une Afrique libre, libre d'opinion, d'expression, tu le sais.
Africa dying, my people crying, every day. Boy, yo, 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 it must be the love night ever, right? Hey, 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 Africa dying, my people crying, every day. Boy, yo, 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 it must be the love night ever, right?
hey 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 mawaska tuniga diga di mawaska tuniga makama mawaska tuniga maise samse lokjo koneka koipa mawaska tuniga maise samse lokjo sinika keipa mawaska tuniga kaka ka mawaska tuniga baika bai mawaska tuniga bai fa samse bani sika tepa alwatu kunni koneka di haka sikano bilse alwatu kunni koneka di apikla baino koneka sai alwatu kunni koneka di borbila baino koneka alwatu kunni koneka di borbisa keno koneka alwatu kunni koneka di wonge ha waipo hai gabu alwatu kunni koneka di wonge ha sakke koneka bu alwatu kunni koneka di iko ka te hakil ka ba mutunika ke ma te apo apikla bai ma te apo borbila bai ma te apo borbisa ke ma te apo e galle shikra ma te apo pido se pido and what you can ma te apo pido bomb pido gas
africa dance my people crying every day
today
yo 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 it's not the beat the love night ever rise time hey 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 africa dance my people crying every day yo 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 it's not the beat the love night ever rise time hey hey hey
man 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 tu sais mon chemin a son unité on a fait que diviser nos dirigeants sont dirigés yeah man plus les babylon déguisés.
Is Kaidine Gaskia of Niger with Africa. Across the Middle East, artists are attacking Islamic State fighters with jokes, mocking the group with music, cartoons and videos. In Beirut, the increasingly popular band The Great Departed draws cheers and laughter as it insults Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. But as Heather Murdock reports from Beirut, band members say they are not only ridiculing the militants, but the political systems that allow them to exist in the first place.
As musicians return to the stage for a final encore, fans shout out the names of their favorite songs. They play Madad Baghdadi, a satiric ode to the Islamic State that makes fun of its extremist version of Islam. Islam is mercy, so we will butcher people and give out the meat, they sing. To reduce traffic, let's kill the human beings. The words mercy, meat, and traffic all rhyme in Arabic. It's the group's most popular song with more than 50,000 hits on YouTube, and prominent media houses around the globe have featured it. This is Khalid Sobia, the band's composer and pianist. He says when a group like the Islamic State claims to be holy and then uses violence to control people, humor is the best way to fight back. But Sobia is also quick to point out that Islamic State is not the only group the band scorns. He says dictators and corruption in the Middle East created an atmosphere that allowed extremism and militancy to grow, and they are equally to blame for the current crisis. Backstage before the show, as the band gets ready, male lead singer Naeem Asmar says jokes are also a coping mechanism that helps people deal with the almost unimaginable violence plaguing the region.
Plus, when you see the contradictions in that reality and the Abbasiyyah, the absurdity of many contradictions, you cannot but be sarcastic about it or make jokes about it. Yeah, well, it's an escape in order not to get mad, not to lose it, actually.
And the Great Departed's El Rahal El Kabir in Arabic. Success comes amid a rush of other media mocking the militants, who have taken over vast territories in Iraq and Syria. Videos and cartoons posted online and on television depict inept, bloodthirsty fighters using the guise of Islam to justify crimes. One joke online refers to Kurdish fighters now battling the Islamic State in Kobani, a Syrian town near the Turkish border that has recently been overrun by militants. What do ISIS and Little Miss Muffet have in common, the joke reads. They both have Kurds in their way. Kurds way, get it? But at the theater, band members say their own satirical attack on the Islamic State hasn't exactly had the impact they expected. Abid Kobayesi plays the buzuk, a traditional instrument that looks a little bit like a guitar. He says politicians use fear of the Islamic State, known as Daesh in Arabic, as a way to distract people from the real issues they face, like corruption, poverty, and development.
One of the main things that we used to discuss off the record during our rehearsals is how Lebanese and Arabic media right now is focusing on Daesh and is doing a whole propaganda of fear around Daesh for the audience to be diverged off the main focus and really relevant issues.
Their song, Madad Baghdadi, he says, gathered enough attention to, in a roundabout way, contribute to the blanket media coverage of the Islamic State to the exclusion of everything else. But he says his audience in Beirut will not just hear a critique of the Islamic State. Other songs in their concert touch on important and recently neglected issues, Kobayesi says. Some songs criticize dictators that tout victories while neglecting the people they rule, or point out things that don't mix well together, like yogurt and fish, and politics and religion. Band members say older Arabic music focuses on love and relationships, and they are working to cultivate a new style that focuses on what really occupies people's minds in the Arab world. Which is, sadly these days, they say, the reality of politics and war. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Beirut.
Many children in northern Uganda, South Sudan and Tanzania are afflicted with a debilitating disease called nodding syndrome. In its early stages, it's characterized by an involuntary nodding of the head. Now, after decades of research, scientists believe they know how the disease is spread. A new report suggests that black flies infected with another parasite may be capable of passing on a secondary pathogen that causes nodding syndrome. Eskild Petersen is professor of tropical medicine and infectious diseases at Aarhus University Hospital in Denmark. Douglas Mpuga reached him by phone to find out more.
We don't know what is causing the nodding disease, so we don't know how it is spread. So that's the fact of it. The paper that we just published in the International Journal of Infectious Diseases put forward a hypothesis that it is related to African river blindness, and that is spread by black flies. And if that hypothesis is right, then it will be spread by black flies, but it is still just a hypothesis and not a true fact.
There's been decades of research to determine the exact cause of this nodding disease. How this hypothesis of yours, how far does it take us? Do we know more now than we knew before?
I think that there's a lot of possibilities that have been excluded, but you still do not have a virus or bacteria where you can say, well, this is the exact cause. So it's still an enigma, and it could be that we are on the wrong track. So what we have published is a hypothesis, and then you have to dig more into it and see if the hypothesis can stand up for further scrutiny.
Are there other related research that point to your hypothesis?
No, not really, because what they've been looking for is known viruses in the central nervous system of these victims, and they have not found any. And they've been looking for white blood cells in the spinal fluid, which is associated with infections, and that looks normal. So if this is an infection, we still have no clue what it is, and we would need to go back and look once more in the victims, and we would also, as proposed in this paper, have to look in the black flies to see if we can find microorganisms in the black flies which can be transmitted to humans.
If your hypothesis was true, how common would that be for, say, one insect to spread two types of diseases?
Well, it's very well known that insects can spread diseases. As I said, black flies are already spreading African river blindness. You have malaria, mosquitoes spreading malaria.
you have yellow fever, mosquito spreading, yellow fever, and other viral infections, dengue fever, and you have chikungunya in the Caribbean right now. So it's very common that insects can spread infections to humans.
It seems there are a lot of questions still that remain unanswered as far as the spreading of the Nordic disease is concerned. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that remain, both investigating the patients, and there's also, if this is a hypothesis, you will have to catch a lot of black flies to see if you can identify bacteria or viruses beside the African river blindness parasite, which would be in the black flies.
And lastly, Dr. Peterson, if your hypothesis be true that the disease may be spread by these flies, what would explain for the disease coming on and off in the regions where it's prevalent?
The regions where it has been flaring up is regions where you have turmoil, and if you have a civil war and so on, then the mosquito control programs are not really working. You can have displaced populations moving from endemic to non-endemic areas, so they have no immunity. So there are very many different explanations that could explain why it's flaring up and on. It is very usual for infectious diseases, and especially vector-borne infectious diseases, where you both have the human population and the vectors, and both of them can be moving and flaring up and down. The vectors are prone to rainfall, for instance. So there's a lot of different factors here.
That was Eskeled Petersen, a professor of tropical medicine and infectious diseases at Aarhus University in Denmark. He was speaking with Douglas Mpuga. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Jackson Nfunganye, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Sanctions have emerged as a leading tool of American foreign policy. The goal, said U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Counter-Threat Finance and Sanctions, Peter Harrell, is to maximize the impact of sanctions while minimizing their costs on innocent civilians and private businesses at home and abroad. Recently, the sanctions tool has been wielded against the growing terrorist threat known as ISIL, or the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. Unlike al-Qaeda, which largely relied on deep-pocketed donors for financing, ISIL derives much of its funding internally from criminal activities. In other words, it raises much of its money through extortion, looting towns and villages, and selling oil in territory under its control. But ISIL also makes use of external sources of funding through oil smuggling to neighboring countries, kidnapping for ransom, and other sources. Countering ISIL's financing is absolutely central to the United States' objective of destroying ISIL and ensuring that it cannot attack the U.S. or its allies. It is part of a broader strategy that also includes conducting a military campaign in Iraq and Syria, preventing foreign fighters from traveling to the region, delegitimizing ISIL's ideology, and providing humanitarian relief to the people of Iraq and Syria. The United States will be working with states bordering Iraq and Syria to prevent ISIL from smuggling oil outside of territory it inhabits or from bringing cash into those places. The U.S. will be using designation authorities to sanction people and companies doing business with ISIL or giving it money. Already, an impressive array of countries is joining the effort. The U.S. is working with partners to build an international coalition that shares information and develops joint approaches to combating ISIL's financing. Private companies will have as important a role to play as governments around the world in cutting off funding to ISIL. The private sector needs to help identify and cut off potential avenues for ISIL's illicit financial flows. Sanctions have a clear and critical role to play in the effort to defeat terrorist threats like ISIL.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.